A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He read an opinion piece in the Times of Israel, arguing maybe Trump is tired of Netanyahu, and maybe Israel is too. His take is that Netanyahu has brought real prosperity, and he rejects the idea that power corrupts automatically as conspiracy theory territory. But his actual question, the thing he's really chewing on, is about detachment. The idea that leaders who accumulate personal wealth and live insulated lives lose touch with what their citizens are actually going through. He points to the cost of living squeeze and the fallout from the Iran war, and he's fascinated by leaders in history who deliberately live modestly among the people to stay connected. So the question is that insulation the ultimate cause of the disconnection between leaders and the public?
There's a lot to pull apart here. And I want to start with the prosperity claim because it's the easiest one to ground in actual numbers. Israel's GDP per capita has roughly doubled since Netanyahu first took office in the late 90s. It's now somewhere around $55,000, which puts it ahead of France and the UK on that metric. The tech sector is the obvious engine, but the broader economic liberalization reforms that started under his first finance minister stint in the early 2000s really did reshape the economy. You can't look at Israel's credit rating upgrades over the last decade and say nothing happened.
Yet the cost of living protests that keep erupting tell a different story.
That's the tension. The macro numbers are real, but the distribution is wildly uneven. I was looking at some data from the Taub Center. Housing prices in Israel have risen something like 220% in real terms since 2008. The average Israeli family now spends roughly a third of their income just on housing. For young couples trying to buy a first apartment, the down payment alone can be the equivalent of 4 or 5 years of median household income.
The prosperity happened, but it didn't land evenly. The CEO of Checkpoint is doing fine. The teacher in Beit Shemesh is not.
And that's where the detachment question gets real. If your personal wealth insulates you from ever worrying about a mortgage or a grocery bill, you can look at those macro numbers and genuinely believe things are great. You're not wrong about the data you're citing, you're just blind to the experience behind the data.
The median income versus the mean. If Jeff Bezos walks into a bar, the average net worth of everyone there jumps to $1 billion, but nobody's drink got cheaper.
That's a perfect way to put it. And with Netanyahu specifically, the personal wealth question isn't just abstract, it's been litigated in court. There's the ongoing corruption trial. Case 1000, case 2000, case 4000. The allegations include receiving hundreds of thousands of shekels worth of cigars and champagne from billionaires like Arnon Milchin and James Packer.
Cigars and champagne. The universal symbols of, I've lost the thread.
The testimony in those cases painted a picture of a lifestyle that's just completely disconnected from the average Israeli experience. We're talking about pink champagne delivered by the case. Cigars worth more per box than some Israelis make in a month. And the legal question is whether these were gifts exchanged for policy favors. But the cultural question, the one Daniel's getting at, is what it does to your psychology when your social circle is billionaires and your daily habits are luxury goods.
The prompt's not really about the legal guilt or innocence, though. It's about the broader phenomenon.
And I think the prompt is onto something that political science has actually been studying. There's a concept called elite cueing, the idea that political elites take their cues from other elites rather than from the public. When your entire social network is other politicians, wealthy donors, and advisors, you develop what researchers call an information bubble. You're not getting unfiltered feedback.
It's not that power corrupts in the mustache-twirling villain sense. It's that power insulates, and insulation distorts.
And the distortion is subtle. It's not that you become evil. It's that you lose the texture of ordinary life. You don't know what a liter of milk costs. You don't know what it feels like to sit in a hospital waiting room for 6 hours because the system is overloaded. You don't know the anxiety of opening an electricity bill after a heat wave.
That last one hits. I remember during one of the heat waves a couple summers back, there were stories of families choosing between air conditioning and food. And meanwhile, you'd see Knesset members arguing about ministerial budgets in air-conditioned offices with catering. It's not malice. It's just a different planet.
The Iran war fallout makes this even sharper. Since the strikes and exchanges escalated, we've seen disruptions to daily life that affect ordinary Israelis in ways that don't touch the political class. Air raid sirens interrupting workdays, kids dealing with trauma, the economic drag of reserve duty pulling people away from their jobs. If you're a Knesset member with a government salary and security detail, you experience those things very differently than a small business owner in Haifa who's lost employees to reserve duty and customers to anxiety.
Let's get to the part of the prompt that I think is actually the most interesting. The leaders who tried not to live that way, who deliberately stayed connected.
The canonical example, and I'm guessing this is who Daniel had in mind, is José Mujica of Uruguay, president from 2010 to 2015. He was known as the world's poorest president, which he himself rejected as a label, but the facts are striking. He donated roughly 90% of his presidential salary to charity. He lived on his wife's farm rather than the presidential palace, drove a 1987 Volkswagen Beetle.
The Beetle became the symbol. But the farm is the detail that matters.
Because it wasn't just performative frugality. He was literally living in a rural setting among neighbors who weren't political elites. His wife, Lucia Topolansky, was also a former guerrilla who became a senator, and they both maintained this ethos of simplicity that came out of their years imprisoned under the dictatorship. They'd been stripped of everything, and they decided not to accumulate again when they got power.
There's something about someone who's been in prison and then becomes president. They've seen both extremes of the state's power over a life.
That's a profound point, and Mujica explicitly connected his lifestyle to his ability to govern. He said, and I'm paraphrasing, that if you live like the majority of your people, you understand them. You don't need a briefing on poverty if you're living modestly yourself.
The briefing versus the experience. That's the whole thing.
There are other examples, too. I was reading about Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso in the 80s. He famously sold off the government's fleet of Mercedes and replaced them with the Renault 5, the cheapest car available. He reduced his own salary and forbade his ministers from using chauffeurs or flying first class. He lived in a modest house on a military salary.
Sankara's a complicated figure because his presidency was short and ended in assassination, but the symbolic power of the Renault 5 fleet is undeniable. It says, we're not here to extract.
There's a deeper structural point here that I think gets missed. When a leader lives modestly, it's not just about empathy or moral example. It changes the information they receive. If you're driving yourself around, you see the potholes. If you're shopping at a regular market, you see the inflation. If your kids go to public school, you know what's broken in the education system.
The pothole theory of governance.
There's a concept in public administration called street-level feedback. Leaders who have direct, unmediated contact with ordinary life get information that doesn't show up in reports or statistics. Reports get sanitized. Ministers have incentives to make things look good, but a pothole doesn't lie.
Mujica's beetle hitting a pothole is actually a governance mechanism.
And contrast that with a leader who moves in a motorcade through pre-cleared routes. They literally don't see the same country.
Let me push back on something, though. The prompt mentions Netanyahu's personal wealth, but if we're being fair, he's not unique among Israeli politicians. A lot of Knesset members are quite comfortable.
That's true, and the data backs it up. There was a report a few years ago by an Israeli NGO that found a significant number of Knesset members have declared assets well above what their government salaries would allow. Some of that is legitimate. Previous careers, family wealth, investments. But the pattern is clear. The Knesset is economically unrepresentative of the population it governs.
That's true of most parliaments, honestly. The question is whether it matters, and I think the prompt is arguing that it does. Not because wealth makes you corrupt, but because it makes you blind.
There's an interesting counterexample from American history. He was famously not wealthy. After his presidency, he and Bess moved back to Independence, Missouri, and lived in her family home. He took no corporate board positions, wrote his memoirs for the money, and lived on a modest pension. He was the last president to leave office without becoming a millionaire.
He's consistently rated as one of the more grounded presidents. The buck stops here, guy.
Here's the thing. Truman was from an era before the modern political fundraising machine. Today, even if you enter politics modest, the system forces you into wealthy circles just to stay viable. You spend half your time on the phone with donors. Those donors are not representative of the public.
There's a structural problem even for leaders who want to stay connected. The job itself isolates you.
And I think that's the deeper insight in the prompt. It's not that individual leaders are uniquely corrupt or detached. It's that the modern political system, in Israel, in the US, in most democracies, has built-in mechanisms that produce detachment. The security bubble, the media handlers, the schedules packed with meetings with other elites.
The security bubble is an interesting one because it's necessary. Israeli prime ministers face real threats, but it's also a perfect metaphor. You're literally surrounded by people whose job is to keep the public at a distance.
That distance becomes normal. You stop noticing it. There's a psychological phenomenon called shifting baseline syndrome. Your reference point for what's normal gradually moves without you realizing it. After a few years in office, having ordinary citizens scream before they can approach you feels normal. Having a driver feels normal. Having someone else manage your schedule and expenses feels normal.
The leader who started out connected doesn't necessarily notice themselves becoming disconnected.
And that's why the deliberate effort to live modestly that the prompt is talking about. It's not just a nice symbolic gesture, it's a countermeasure against a very real psychological drift.
Let me bring this back to Israel specifically. The cost of living crisis here isn't abstract. We're talking about a country where a basic apartment in the center can cost the equivalent of $1 million. Where young families are moving to the periphery, not because they want to, but because they're priced out. Where teachers and nurses' commutes are getting longer every year because they can't afford to live near their jobs.
The political response to this has been, let's say, uneven. There have been various housing reform plans, various committees, various promises. But the fundamental dynamic, the price of land, the concentration of ownership, the permitting process, hasn't shifted dramatically. And you have to ask, if more Knesset members were personally feeling the housing squeeze, would the policy response be different?
The prompt's thesis would say yes.
I think there's good reason to believe that. We have evidence from other contexts. There's research showing that when legislators have school-aged children in public schools, they're more attentive to education funding. When they have personal experience with the healthcare system as patients rather than VIPs, they're more attuned to wait times and gaps in coverage.
The VIP lane at the hospital is another perfect example. Every Israeli knows it exists. If you're a minister, you don't wait in the emergency room. But the existence of that separate experience means you literally don't know how bad the wait is.
It's not because you're a bad person. It's because you have a different experience. You can read reports about wait times, but reports don't capture the feeling of sitting in a plastic chair at 3 a.m. with a sick child and no update.
That's the texture thing again.
And texture matters for governance. It's what turns an abstract policy problem into something you viscerally want to solve.
Let's get to the historical examples. The prompt mentioned loving to learn about leaders who lived among the people. We talked about Mujica, Sankara, Truman.
There's an interesting example from more recent history that I think gets overlooked. Aung San Suu Kyi in Myanmar. Obviously, her legacy is deeply complicated now because of the Rohingya crisis. But before that, during her years under house arrest, she became a symbol precisely because she refused to leave the country when she could have. She stayed in her home, under surveillance, while her family was abroad. The connection to place was real.
Though the arc of that story is a cautionary tale, staying connected doesn't guarantee you'll govern well once you actually get power.
That's a crucial caveat. Modest living is not a guarantee of good governance. Sankara was assassinated. Suu Kyi presided over atrocities. The symbolic connection is not the same as effective or just leadership.
The prompt isn't saying modest leaders are always good. It's saying the disconnection is the problem, and modest living is a potential solution, but it's not a magic wand.
Another example that comes to mind is Václav Havel in the Czech Republic. After the Velvet Revolution, he became president and famously continued to live in a modest apartment rather than moving into Prague Castle full-time. He held office hours where ordinary citizens could come speak to him. He walked around the city without an entourage.
Havel's interesting because he was a playwright, not a career politician. He came from outside the system.
There's a pattern there. A lot of the leaders known for staying connected are people who came to power through movements rather than through party machinery. They had a base of support that was personal and ideological rather than transactional and donor-driven. That made them less dependent on elite networks.
The movement versus the machine.
When your political survival depends on grassroots support rather than donor support, you have different incentives. You stay connected because you have to.
That raises a question about the prompt's framing of Netanyahu. He's been elected multiple times. He clearly has grassroots support. So how does the detachment thesis square with his electoral success?
That's the puzzle, isn't it? I think part of the answer is that voters evaluate leaders on multiple dimensions. You can think someone is out of touch personally, but still support their security policies, their economic vision, or their diplomatic approach. The detachment doesn't necessarily cost you votes if voters prioritize other things.
Or if they don't see a better alternative on the detachment dimension.
If all the viable candidates are living in the same elite bubble, detachment isn't a differentiator. It's just the background condition.
This system produces a menu of detached options, and voters pick based on other criteria.
That's a structural critique, not an individual one. It's not. Netanyahu is uniquely detached. It's the Israeli political class as a whole is unrepresentative, and Netanyahu is the most prominent example.
I think that's a fair way to put it, and it connects to something the prompt gestures at. The idea that power corrupts automatically is conspiracy theory thinking. The prompt's right to reject that. It's not automatic. It's a slow drift, driven by incentives and environment, that some leaders resist and others don't.
There's a great line from Robert Caro's biography of Lyndon Johnson. He describes how Johnson, early in his career, would drive himself around the Texas Hill Country, stopping to talk to farmers and ranchers, getting a feel for what mattered to them. And as he rose in Washington, that connection frayed. It wasn't that he became evil, it was that the Senate cloakroom replaced the Texas ranch as his reference point.
The reference point shifts. That's exactly it.
The prompt's question, is this the ultimate cause of disconnection? I think the answer is that it's one of the major causes, but not the only one. There's also the media environment, which rewards outrage and simplifies complexity. There's the time pressure of modern governance, which pushes leaders toward quick decisions based on staff summaries rather than deep engagement. There's the sheer complexity of modern states, which makes it impossible for any leader to personally understand every policy domain.
Modest living helps, but it's not sufficient. You also need systems that force exposure to reality.
And I think that's where the historical examples are instructive. Mujica didn't just live modestly, he also maintained an open-door culture in his administration. Havel didn't just live in an apartment, he held public office hours. The lifestyle and the systems reinforced each other.
The lifestyle without the systems is just cosplay.
We've seen versions of that. Politicians who do a photo op in a modest home and then go back to their gated community, or who talk about understanding working families while their net worth puts them in the top fraction of a percent.
The I feel your pain school of detachment.
Which voters can smell? There's research on this. Voters are surprisingly good at detecting authenticity versus performance. The leaders who get credit for modesty are the ones who live it consistently, not the ones who do it for the cameras.
Let me circle back to the Iran war dimension because it's in the prompt and it's not a minor detail. We're living through a period where ordinary Israelis have been dealing with rocket attacks, sirens, economic disruption, and the psychological toll of an extended conflict. And the political class experiences the conflict primarily through briefings and secure rooms.
The secure room is the perfect metaphor for the whole problem. It's a room designed to keep danger out, and in doing so, it also keeps reality out. You're getting information through screens and reports. You're not hearing the sirens the same way. You're not running to the shelter with your kids.
To be fair, the Prime Minister does have to be in a secure room sometimes. That's not a criticism. It's just a description of the structural problem. The job requires insulation.
Which is why the countermeasure has to be deliberate. If the job pushes you toward detachment, you have to push back. You have to build habits and systems that reconnect you.
What would that look like in practice? If you were designing a political system to minimize detachment, what would you do?
I think a few things. One, term limits. The longer someone is in power, the more their reference point shifts. Regular rotation forces fresh perspectives.
Though term limits also have downsides. You lose experience. You empower the permanent bureaucracy.
2. Transparency requirements that are actually enforced. Not just asset declarations, but real-time disclosure of meetings, gifts, and conflicts. Make the insulation visible so voters can factor it in.
3. I'd add, public services that are universal. No VIP lanes at the hospital, no separate schools for the elite. If the powerful have to use the same services as everyone else, they'll make sure those services work.
That's a profound point, the universal service model. It's one of the reasons the Nordic countries consistently score high on governance metrics. Their elites use the same public systems. It aligns incentives.
4. And this is more cultural than structural, a norm that values modesty. In some political cultures, displaying wealth is a liability. In others, it's expected. Shifting that norm is slow work, but it matters.
5. And I think this is the one the prompt is really driving at. Leaders need to have genuine, unmediated contact with ordinary citizens. Not town halls with screen questions. Not photo ops. Real conversations where people can tell them things they don't want to hear.
The Mujica model. The Havel model.
And those models are rare because they're uncomfortable. Power doesn't like discomfort. The whole machinery of office is designed to minimize friction, and friction is exactly what keeps you connected.
The friction is the point.
Remove the friction, and you float away.
To pull this together for the prompt, the disconnection is real. It's not about automatic corruption. It's about the gradual drift that comes from insulation. And the antidote is deliberate friction. Leaders who choose discomfort. Systems that force exposure. A culture that values modesty over display.
I'd add, the prompt's instinct to push back on the power corrupts automatically. Narrative is correct. That framing is too simple, too moralistic, and it lets the system off the hook. If power automatically corrupted, we wouldn't have counterexamples like Mujica or Havel or Truman. The fact that we do have counterexamples tells us that the system matters as much as the individual.
The system sets the default. The individual can override the default, but it takes effort.
Most people, most of the time, don't override the default. That's why the default matters so much.
Which brings us back to Netanyahu and the specific question, has he brought prosperity? The macro numbers say yes. Is he detached? The lifestyle evidence says yes. Are those two things in tension? That's the puzzle the prompt is sitting with.
I think the honest answer is that they're both true, and the tension is real. You can deliver economic growth and still be out of touch with how that growth is experienced. You can be a skilled political operator and still live in a bubble. The question isn't whether the detachment exists, it's what it costs in terms of policy blind spots and public trust.
Whether the public eventually decides, the detachment outweighs the prosperity.
That's the electoral question, and it's not one we can answer from this side of the microphone. But the prompt's framing, that this is about connection, not corruption, I think that's exactly right. It's a more nuanced way to think about leadership, and it points towards solutions that are about design rather than just about character.
Design rather than character. That's a good place to land.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The largest stony iron meteorite ever found is the Hoba meteorite in Namibia, weighing about 60 tons. But the largest pure stony meteorite is the Jilin meteorite that fell in China in 1976, with the main mass weighing nearly 2 tons, and its mineral composition is mostly olivine and orthopyroxene, which are minerals you can also find in Earth's mantle.
I now know more about olivine than I planned to today. This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you've got thoughts on detachment, modesty, or potholes as governance mechanisms, we'd love to hear them.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from longing. time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.